This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 56th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me today Sammy Miguez. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Gary.
Sammy's last name gets pronounced many, many ways, but Miguez is the right way, right?
That is correct.
Sammy Miguez is Principal and Director of Knowledge Management at Cigital. Sammy's keen interest in inventing, identifying, and instructing others about computer security issues spans decades. Sammy co-authored the BSIM model and remains instrumental in its evolution. In previous positions, Sammy was VP of Knowledge Management at CyberTrust, formerly known as TrueSecure, Chief Scientist at iDefense, and an analyst in the U.S. Air Force. Sammy holds a BS in CS from the University of Southwestern Louisiana and an MS in CS from Eastern Michigan University. He lives in Virginia with his son. So, you've spent decades in the trenches of computer security, starting in the Air Force and leading multiple startups. What keeps you motivated to work in this field?
Well, it's certainly not the emphasis you put on the word decades, but really it's because it's always changing. There are some issues that we knew about in the early 80s that we keep making today. How does data work? How should we protect against threats? We had some really good ideas about data-centric security 30 years ago. And as we continue to get an influx of, I'll call them young folk, not newbies, into security, we keep making some of the same old mistakes over and over again. We do them with different languages, we do them with technologies, but we've known about a lot of things for a long time.
So you just like knowing the answers in advance.
Yes, I studied for this test 30 years ago. I really did.
I see. Well, that's one reason to keep interested. Do you think we've made any progress, Sammy?
In the low-level knowledge that we have of how things work, I think we're still where we were 30 years ago. Computers work pretty much the same way. Communications protocols work pretty much the same way. There are a lot of things that work pretty much the same way. As we've leveraged the business needs on top of them, though, we've invented new things every year. And we've changed the attack surfaces. We've changed the attack paths. We've changed the risks with the business. So it is constantly moving. And even those old lessons have to be reapplied over and over and over again.
Making it fun and creative.
Well, exactly.
And interesting.
Exactly.
So more than one security guru has rural southern roots, which is interesting. Becky Bass is from southern Louisiana, like yourself. And Avi Rubin and Dan Gere are from Tennessee, like me. So how does your southern upbringing inform and influence your work in computer security?
Wow, that's a good one. I've always had to do a lot with a little, even as a kid. And so I really appreciate the need to get in there and understand how things are actually working. It's interesting to talk with some folks today and have them not necessarily understand how a computer works, but they're working on computer security problems. And so I think it's that approach from having to do whatever was necessary to really understand the problem and fix it that really informs how I do what I do today.
That's interesting. How about skepticism? How about speaking truth to power and redneck sensibility? any of that?
I'm not sure I know what that means. I'm lost. Redneck sensibility. I mean, so you
too
actually
much of an oxymoron.
You actually have Earl Scheib paint the car before you put it up on blocks in your yard. I'm lost.
Well, no, seriously, taking a skeptical view of the powers that be, of the way things are supposed to be, you know, I guess this notion of wanting to get to the bottom of how something works is related to that. But I'm thinking more of a skeptical stance.
So my skepticism really comes from the people who say this is the answer. And I got to say that just, you know, that flips my bogometer immediately, because their assumptions have not been, usually have not been adequately documented for anyone. So we tell people this firewall is the answer, this tool is the answer, this process is the answer. And we never finish the sentence, or the vendors or the whoever's trying to sell you something never finish the sentence and say, under these circumstances, for these people, not to be taken internally, you know, and all these other things. And
all the small print.
All the small print. And so what happens is, you get this and you move on. And when enough people do it, it becomes the solution. But it just, it's not necessarily your solution. And we still have way too much of that going on.
So you were involved in early work on DDoS attacks and mm-hmm. kind of the dawn of botnets. How do endpoint security problems exacerbate distributed systems risk? In particular, address the issue of home PCs, iPads, Android phones, and smart grid meters.
Wow, that's like when
this is an essay question.
You're right. When the reporter only gets one question to the president, and they make it a four-parter, and then he talks about something completely different anyway.
Pulls a Gorbachev. Yeah,
so what I'd like to talk about is the leaves this year. They look really good in response to your question. Uh-huh. So distributed denial of service attacks, there was some early work that went on sponsored by CERT. They got a bunch of people together. They talked about the problem and really sort of started to drive the issue to where it could at least be addressed in the short term, and that was to the big ISPs. Mm-hmm. But again, as you pointed out, the real issue was that there were so many bots that could go around that could generate these large DDoSes. So then we got to the endpoint security. I got to tell you, that's started up as a market over the last few years. But, we're still basically stuck at antivirus and a few other tools. And mm-hmm. in fact, some of the free tools from sites that we would normally not even visit work just as well as some of the other tools that we see in the commercial space. However, there's still no solution for the average person at home. So there's still as many bots out there as there were before, but as a proportion of the total number of computers on the internet, it's grown astronomically. So I think we're way worse off than we were before in terms of number of systems that are being used to do bad things. And quite frankly, I don't think the average person has anything they can do about it.
Does the rise of mobile computation, of cell phone stuff, impact this in one way or the other, or was it already turned to 11?
Well, I don't know that cell phones are going to impact, I don't know that mobile computing devices in and of themselves are going to impact this very much. I know there's a lot of them, but they don't necessarily have a lot of CPU horsepower. So they can be used for small nuisance things, like if I made a million cell phones, I'll call 911 at once. But I don't know that I could use a bunch of cell phones to bring down Amazon for a few seconds. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the use of cloud things, when we start using that computing power, there's a story just recently where someone used some cloud power to decode some keys. That's kind of interesting. Again, if we were able to split a bunch of work across some cell phones, that might get interesting too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was reading a paper by Dan Geer just this morning, and he said something about Kerberos not really working so well anymore, in the sense that you used to assume that I'm okay, you're okay, and the network in between us is kind of screwed up.
Right.
And now it's, I think I'm okay, maybe, and I know you're rooted, and the network's going to make this worse.
Right. So what we're doing is we're gaining some assurance. No, we're losing some assurance. Gee, I don't know what the right answer is. Mm-hmm. So is Kerberos protecting the hackers' traffic more than ours? Are we guaranteeing that we can't catch what they're doing because it's all invisible to our tools? I don't know.
So let's turn to smart grid and power grid stuff, just in case we're not worried enough yet. You have a video on the Justice League blog where you're addressing an audience of rural electric cooperative CEOs at the NRECA conference. What's up with that?
So there was an issue there where a lot of small cooperatives are having to uptake a lot of smart grid technology in a very short time. And I say have to in a good way, because, you know, all this money came from the government and all this money is being used to buy equipment and it's all being pushed into these organizations. But these organizations, by and large, have not had to deal with this from a risk perspective. By and large, they're small organizations. The IT organization is one guy.
Yeah, somebody's cousin or something like that.
Maybe two, right. The leadership changes every year, and, you know, the CEO gets elected. He's the guy who also owns the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is we're rolling out millions and millions of pieces of equipment to form a new, I don't know, call it whatever you want, a new network, a new heterogeneous thing that has its own attack surface, its own code, its own everything. And we're rolling it out to people who are not necessarily experts. So for me, this is different from the old days where we were rolling out, you know, TACs and ARPANET sites and all this other stuff, and we're rolling them out to real experts who knew exactly how to build them, configure them, run them, and do everything else with them. Now we're rolling out things that are extremely complicated, that are being built by vendors for the first time, using technologies that they don't necessarily, software development technologies, that they don't necessarily have a really firm grasp on from a security perspective. Mm-hmm. And we're giving them to people who have no choice but to treat them as a black box.
Sounds like fun.
So this seems, as we say, fraught with danger.
So part of your job is to give those guys a little bit of education and also what?
So through our work with NRECA, our job is to help these small cooperatives manage the risk of installing this new equipment into their environment. And so we're going to be working directly with them and then through them with the vendors. And we're going to do that in a couple of ways, both by, you know, helping them with their RFP language as they acquire this technology, mm-hmm. and then helping them to ask the right questions so that they know what it means to actually have this technology in their environment.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigil.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. Okay, did you bring a number two pencil for this talk?
Absolutely.
Okay, so write this down. What's a greater risk and why? Insider threats, social engineering a la Mitnick, crappy configuration, or shoddy construction?
Wow. So if I can turn that around a little bit and say, you know, what's the greatest source of risk, which is to say, what's the greatest source of damage to my organization? I have to go with, you know, my people doing the wrong thing. And whether that's any of those is up for grabs. So my people might do the wrong thing because they got socially engineered. My people might do the wrong thing in messing up a configuration of an item. They might do the wrong thing in a number of ways. And I really think that's where we are right now. They're either writing bad code, they're configuring items incorrectly, or they're listening to the wrong person and making security decisions. I think really, really, that's where we are right now for the source of a lot of risk.
That's interesting. So shoddy construction sort of fell off of your radar there.
Well, I can only remember three things, so my brain has some shoddy construction.
Well, that's why I put it last, Sammy.
So I was following from the beginning. So, you know, shoddy construction, but, you know, again, from a software perspective, I don't know that shoddy construction is the right phrase. Let's call it uninformed construction. You know, like the little piggy who built the house out of straw, but, you know, you wouldn't do that next to the volcano. So we're pulling these risks into our organization on a must-do kind of timeline. We must roll this out. The government is paying for it. The states are asking for it. The constituents are asking for it in terms of smart grid. And we're going to have to manage the risk as we go along, which of course puts, you know, people like us in the worst possible position.
Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the people listening to this podcast can't see your bright orange shirt, which I'm sure you wore because you were a co-author of the Orange Book.
Oh, right? Wow. No, yeah. So I contributed some material. There were hundreds of authors of the Orange Book.
Yeah, sure. Everybody always shies away from credit for that one.
No, really. Seriously.
So do you think we've made tangible progress in software security since the days of the Orange Book?
Well, the Orange Book wasn't really about software, but yes, I think we've made some real progress since the days of the Orange Book. It's the kind of progress that's a little frustrating. In other words, we've gotten smarter about how to do certain things more correctly, but we still haven't figured out how to get the word out to everybody. You know, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but there's that old chestnut that goes around that it took, 10 years to get the first, whatever it was, 25,000 C programmers. Hmm. And we got 1 million Java programmers in the first year and a half or something like that.
Well, and some of them had 7 years of experience.
Yeah, that's right. You remember that was pretty funny. That was on someone's resume for those of you listening at home. How do we get the word out to all of those guys, which you mentioned training earlier? Training is a big interest of mine. Really the most basic things. How do we get people to just use, this construct and instead of that one? How do we make old things go away? How do we deprecate things? And this is a huge problem because, a lot of software stuff that was invented in the last 20 years was really shoddy construction.
I want to push on that a little bit. So you said teach people how to do it right, which I like to emphasize. Mm-hmm. Something like defensive coding, as opposed to the bug parade, which tells you here's a bug, there's a bug, here's how they get exploited.
Sure.
People seem to like the latter because it's sexy and it falls right into the NASCAR effect very nicely. But isn't defensive programming more important than that?
Well,
what are you seeing?
So, obviously, defensive programming is going to help you more in the long run. The bug parade is going to maybe help build some awareness. Maybe it's going to get some people in your organization interested in the issue. If David Letterman has top 10 lists, aren't top 10 lists good? Well, they're good for David Letterman, but they're not necessarily the best thing to help get your organization on the right track for what it needs for your code, for your technologies, for your business issues. And so that level of training, pulling what everyone knows to what you should do, seems to be one of the big problems right now. How do we get that done? And as we're trying to address that every day.
Okay, so what's so great about the BSIM model? And full disclosure, I'm co-author of the study along with Brian Chess and Sammy on this one.
Yes, so what's good about it is much like, a basic framework, a metaphor for a problem, anyone can pick up the BSIM and understand it. So to me, initially, that's one of the best things about it. The second best thing, which is the first best thing from a scientific perspective, is that it's real data made up from real things, from real people. We went out and we interviewed people and we found out what they were actually doing and then we documented it.
A little harder to argue with that, I suppose.
Well, you can. We've seen people try, but really it's consumable. And it's data that is actually applicable to a broad array of things. Again, not everybody is going to be the same, but the fact that, 25 out of 30 organizations are doing this, or, 15 out of 20 financial institutions, might seem to throw some credence to, well, this is pretty popular. This is pretty useful. Everybody else is spending money on it. Maybe it's something I should take a look at.
Mm-hmm. So we just ran a conference where you were in attendance, as was I. It was kind of interesting for me to watch these guys who run software security initiatives meet each other, especially when they were from the same vertical, like when the Bank of America guys met the Wells Fargo guys. It was sort of an epiphany for them all. Tell us a little bit about your observations at that conference and what you think about the emerging community of software security practitioners.
So there's something that interesting that happens when you are the guy sitting in the chair and you have to make the decision, and you you get a different view on things because your decision is final. You get input from a lot of people, but your decision is final. And that sort of changes how you look at the world. Meeting a bunch of other people who are sitting in a very similar chair, who have to make very similar decisions, even if they're competitors. Pick whatever, you know, word you want to use there, you know, camaraderie or anything. But there's an understanding that we are facing the same problem and we have to make similar decisions and we should take the time to learn from each other in a social setting. And I saw a lot of that going on, just, you know, the older guys talking to the younger guys, the ones who are emphasizing one vertical, you know, ISVs or high tech, you know, talking to the financial institution guys, you know, the high tech guys really trying to understand more about compliance and why that drives so much business from the financial institution guys, learning more about testing and real hardcore, you know, software development techniques and technologies. It was fantastic.
So you're currently in possession of a grown son. How did your internet use policy at home evolve from the years when your son was 13 to 19?
In a couple of ways. That's actually very interesting. So he always had access to a computer ever since he was very young. For years, he used a computer at work, a Mac 2 SE, because I was a single parent and I brought him to work with me a lot. And then after a while, he got his own computer and it wasn't really connected to the internet. It just played a lot of games and he didn't really know the difference. Mm-hmm. And then once he really got his internet connection, the best thing I could think to do without actually putting censorship on his computer was to put the computer where I could see it. Mm-hmm. So I actually put his computer in the dining room. I gave him a corner of the dining room table because we hardly ever eat at the formal dining room table, and put his monitor there and then put his computer under the sideboard and everything. So there's really just a monitor and a keyboard there. And that worked very well. You know, whenever he was banging away on the keyboard, I knew that he was doing some sort of social media with his friends. Mm-hmm. And whenever he was really, really quiet, I'd walk over and take a look. You know, and that's really how things went. Now, here's the downside of that. He's going to be 21 soon, and that monitor and that keyboard are still on the corner of that dining room table. So you must have a migration plan if you're going to do it my way. And the migration plan has to be to migrate your 21-year-old at least to another room, if not to an apartment. I haven't actually worked out that technology yet.
Uh-huh. So did you ever use censorship technology at all or monitoring technology?
No, I did occasionally check the logs in a little box I set up. I did occasionally check the logs in our wireless router, but I never saw anything that caused me any concern outgoing, incoming, interesting, all the attacks and all the things. But really, we went through the don't click on it. Here's how to Google something to see if it's a scam, right, and a few other odds and ends, and then kept, you know, a few tools running on his machine. And I have to tell you, we've only had two instances of something really bad getting into the home network in 15 years now.
I think this is getting harder, though, you know, with the smartphone pile and these little devices that are easy to just pick up and carry from the corner mm-hmm. of the dining room table into your very own bedroom. It makes it a little bit harder to police. So,
well,
I guess you got out of the problem luckily by timing.
Well, it's still going through my wireless network, even though, you know, he's pushing 21 now. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think, you know, we crossed a chasm there, as it were, where he's gotten old enough to sort of police himself and his traffic. And now I hear him policing his friends. You know, hey, I just got this IM from you that's just click a link. Did you really send me that?
Right.
And that's really cool. That's satisfying when you hear, you know, the lesson being pushed on,
nice,
you know, to others. Yeah.
Nice, nice. So last question. You are quite the connoisseur when it comes to bourbon, as I well know. And my porch well knows. What are your favorite bourbons and why?
Oh, wow. So right now I'm looking at what's referred to as the, I think it's called the Antique Collection, published here, produced here in the United States. So there's three or four that are very good. So there's George T. Stagg, and there's William LaRue Weller. There's Pappy Van Winkle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple of others. There's the Eagle Rare 17-year-old, and then there's a Sazerac Rye 18-year-old. That's very good. But the reason why they're good, and I tie this back to a lot of other things, including software security, is that they don't need to be diluted. They work exactly as they are. You pour them from the bottle into a glass and you drink them. There's no ice, there's no mixers, there's no anything. And again, it's like the software security solutions that we talk about all the time. You take it and you apply it and it works. And quite frankly, you take this bourbon, you apply it liberally and it works. And I have to say I'm okay with that.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P features a roundtable conversation about cloud computing and security. That conversation features Eric Gross from Google, Steve Schmidt from Amazon, Jim Rivas from the Cloud Security Alliance, John Howie from Microsoft, and James Ransom from Cisco. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.